The wise men entered the house and saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasure chest and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. When it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. After the wise men were gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up, flee to Egypt with the child and his mother," the angel said. "Stay there until I tell you to return, because Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." That night, Joseph left for Egypt with the child and Mary, his mother, and they stayed there until Herod's death. This fulfilled what the Lord had spoken through the prophet, "I called my son out of Egypt." Herod was furious when he realized that the wise men had outwitted him. He sent soldiers to kill all the boys in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years and under, based on the wise men's report of the star's first appearance. Herod's brutal action fulfilled what God had spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A cry was heard in Ramah, reaping and great mourning. Rachel weeps for her children, refusing to be comforted, for they are dead. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt. "Get up," the angel said. "Take the child and his mother back to the land of Israel, because those who were trying to kill the child are dead." So Joseph got up and returned to the land of Israel with Jesus and his mother. But when he learned that the new ruler of Judea was Herod's son Archelaus, he was afraid to go there. Then, after being warned in a dream, he left for the region of Galilee. So the family went and lived in a town called Nazareth. This fulfilled what the prophets had said: "He will be called a Nazarene."
We're wrapping up this sermon series, looking at the birth of Jesus through Matthew. The first part that we're going to start off with is pretty familiar. It plays out in most of the nativities. Matthew records that on coming to the house, that is after the wise men, after the magi had stopped by Herod and said, "Hey, look, king, we're here to see the real king of the Jews that's newborn. Can you point us in his direction?" Which totally freaked Herod out. He sends them on their way, and they find their way to Jesus. And it says, on coming to the house, the magi saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. Now, obviously, this is the part where the magi bring their gifts. And I've heard a lot of different things about these gifts, that they represent different aspects of Jesus' life, and maybe so. But even going back 350 years before this, we have records of gold, frankincense, and myrrh being given to kings. It was a common thing for people to bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh to announce the coming or the inauguration, the start of the rule of a king. Gold is obviously gold. Frankincense and myrrh were both resins that come from trees or bushes or something. In today's dollars, frankincense would have been worth, as far as we can tell, about $1,000 per pound. Myrrh would have been about $8,000 per pound. Nobody that Joseph ever knew had ever seen frankincense and myrrh. They might have smelled it when they went to the temple or something. They might have smelled it as they were passing by. But nobody of Mary and Joseph's class would have ever thought that they would have had gold, frankincense, and myrrh. It was not possible for them to have this. It's quite possible. It absolutely is true that these three items spoke to the expectation of the Magi that Jesus was the true King of Israel. It's possible that it represents aspects of his kingship, of his being a priest, of his death and his resurrection. I've heard different things that all this might represent. Myrrh was sometimes used for embalming. It was also sometimes used as a weight loss drug. So, I mean, it was used for a lot of different things. I don't know specifically if the Magi understood what it was meant for, but practically, Mary and Joseph would have made good use of this, I'm sure. They had things coming up that were, if you were of Mary and Joseph's caliber, class of people, you worked today for that food. That was how you lived. You didn't have refrigerators to store up things long-term, things like that. the amount of money that you made was enough to make it that day. And what you could do with what you had was enough was to get through that day. They had stuff coming up that was going to put them outside of their normal relationships that would have helped them. They certainly wouldn't have been able to work or be productive the way that normal people would have, the way Joseph normally would have. So I think symbolically, this is clearly representing, it would have said to the people, this is not what normal people get. This is what kings get. And then practically, it would have been something that would have been useful for Mary and Joseph. I can go that far for sure. And that's about the end of the nativity birth story. Like when you see the nativity sets, like with Jesus, it collapses down everything from, you know, the angels to like, this probably was like, you know, several months at least after Jesus was born, that the Magi end up around Jesus. And this is kind of the end of that kind of basic nativity set where you collapse down all these experiences. The next part that pops up is usually what people don't talk about when they talk about the birth of Jesus. Continuing Matthew chapter 2. When the Magi had, having been warned in the dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. I want you to just realize how offensive. Not only they show up to Herod and they're like, "Hi, you're not the reason we're here. We're here to see the true king." And once they're done seeing the true king, they don't even go back. They make sure to avoid him on the way out. Okay. This could hardly be any more offensive. Certainly again, Herod was here last week, we talked about the political dynamics that were taking place here. Herod is this newly appointed king by the Romans, but he's in this border town, Parthia. You're really expecting them to attack here soon. These Magi are coming from Parthia. He's kind of freaking out about his position, his status here. And then they don't even show him the respect to show to go back and see him on the way back out. So that's what's happening to Herod. So when these Magi are gone, an angel of the Lord appears to Joseph in a dream. By the way, I think it's interesting that Joseph is visited by an angel several times. Like he has specific instructions that are given to him several times. And I think like, man, that would be awesome to know exactly what to do, you know? On the other hand, I say several times, three times. You think about all of the decisions, the daily decisions that Joseph had to make for his family, and only three times was he told what to do. I imagine even if he's told what he's going to do here, okay, he goes and does that. Every single day he's wondering like, well, what about this detail? And what about that? And it would have been nice every day to get a vision from an angel, and he doesn't get it. So much of what Mary and Joseph did was wrapped up in their righteousness. As soon as we hear about Joseph, what we hear about him is he's a righteous man, and he makes decisions based on his spiritual formation that comes from an attentiveness to as much as he understands it to be submissive to God. That's his default position. Not that he always gets things right. Initially, he thought that he would put Mary away quietly so that it wouldn't mess up. It wouldn't, so that her character wouldn't be besmirched. The angel comes and says, no, you're supposed to marry her. And then he does that. So, it wasn't that he didn't have enough information to always do the right thing. He needed to be told by the angels specifically what to do. But he was always operating out of a character that was fit to God's conscience. And I think about all the different ways that my character is formed, and how much of my spiritual formation is not based on the character of God, you know? Anyway, I think about this was a righteous man whose character is fit to the character of God. And what he needed to do was so significant that he still needed three times and he was given specific instructions. So you think about the threading the needle here through all this, how important it was to get this just right. So Joseph is told in a dream, get up, take the child back to his mother and escape to Egypt. This is weird. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So he got up and took his child and mother during the night and left for Egypt, and while where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I will call my son. Egypt is interesting because at this point, there are a lot of Israelite, a lot of Jews living in Israel, in Memphis, in Alexandria, a lot of smaller communities. We don't know where in Egypt they went. There were large Jewish communities in several places in Egypt. And I think about how in Jewish history, how Egypt was the place that they came from, escaping persecution. And here, Joseph is told to carry his family back into Egypt to escape persecution. There's almost like a redemptive arc there for Egypt and especially for the Israelites in Egypt, because they are the closest place that Herod doesn't have any control over. Herod is the one, not Egypt, Herod, the Jewish ruler, is the one working to thwart the will of God. And they're being called back into Egypt for rescue. And I just think about how the arc of restoration, of God redeeming things, means that things that you thought were true before aren't always going to be true. What you think about people that you know before aren't always going to be true. Things that you might have... you might have a memory of a person that harmed you. Always remembering that God is a God of redemption. And we can't hold on to our pre-existing views of people, of individuals, of groups of people based on the past when God can redeem them in the present. I just think it's beautiful that it is Egypt that he goes to for salvation. It says, out of Egypt I will call my son. In Hosea, son is referencing Egypt generally. And Matthew here is taking this whole concept of out of Egypt I will call my son, that is my people, and he's laying that on Jesus himself. He's saying that Jesus is the representation, the culmination of everything that I've been working to do through all of Israel. It wouldn't have been lost on the people reading this book to say, it would have been jarring for them to hear that Jesus himself is the icon that represents all of Israel. Everything that, when I read this, I thought initially as a Jewish person, I'm reading Hosea and I'm thinking, oh yeah, so we as a people will be called out of Egypt. I think we'll be called out of the slavery of Egypt. And Matthew's instead using this and saying, no, the point of Israel, the whole reason that Israel exists is what I'm pointing to. It's not us as a people. It is the salvation that will emerge from us as a people that these prophecies are referring to. So Joseph and his family take off, probably takes about a week to get down there. In the meantime, Herod is livid. When Herod realizes that he has been outwitted by the Magi, I appreciate this translation, he was furious, and he ordered to kill all the baby boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under. Now, he didn't know exactly how old Jesus was. Certainly, he would have done anything to maintain his power. He's really old at this point. He's got to be near his deathbed. He's got everything lined up so that his sons, he just wrote into his will, his three sons are going to receive his kingdom. And this thing that's going on from these Magi are going to thwart his plans. So, of course, he's going to try to have them killed. Now, this is in the histories of Herod, this never comes up. And there's a good reason. It doesn't make his top 30 list of atrocities. Most of the things that we hear about Herod take place in Jerusalem. That's where the histories were more interested in. Just like today, people don't care so much about if you're if you're insignificant, you don't get as much attention as if you're significant. So like when Herod goes to kill his wife, that's a big deal. Herod kills 20 babies that don't matter out in the countryside. That's not a big deal. It's kind of like that. Totally fits the character that we see from Herod. He is a brutal man. And you wonder, like, why would God allow this to happen? That could be a really long sermon series, but I just want to say this. The whole point of the story of the coming of the Messiah is though that this doesn't happen. When we usually say, like, how could God allow this to happen? We imagine him exerting some sort of overwhelming force that subdues our will and makes it impossible for us to continue to do wrong. Or actually, it's usually not us that we're thinking about. It's other people that we want him to stop them from doing wrong. God seems to operate not by the subduing of free will, but the wooing of people towards his goodwill. And we read these stories and we think this is brutal. This is off probably a dozen, maybe two dozen kids killed, but gosh, it's a drop in the bucket compared to everything that was happening. The 3,000, enough people killed that crosses line the avenue all the way to the sea. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's normal for Herod. So yeah, this is awful. This is awful in the midst of a great deal of awful. And that is exactly the reason that the Jews were looking for a Messiah. And that is exactly the reason that Jesus came. It is awful. So he had all the boys from Bethlehem killed in the vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said throughout the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. This is from Jeremiah 31. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. Again, he's quoting from the Old Testament, and this is a reference to the entire people of Israel. Rachel kind of represents kind of the generic mother of the people of Israel at this time. So he is referencing all of the people of Israel when he's talking about Jesus's specific account and what's happening specifically with Jesus. Matthew has an intent for us to bring our entire thought about the Old Testament to bear onto Christ himself, not to be thinking about Israel, not to be thinking about, but the whole point of all of this, the whole point that he started with all the way back with Abraham, was the redemption of all humanity. And Matthew is saying all of that weight, all of that history, all that culture is resting on this pinnacle, this one moment of Christ. This is where it's all coming together. This is the moment that makes all of history make sense in Matthew's mind. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because there are no more. And then it says, after Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared again to Joseph in Egypt and said, get up and take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead. Now, this is probably, I mean, I think probably under a year. Looking at the dates are kind of confusing to figure out, like, exactly when he was born and all that kind of stuff. But it looks to me it was about, I don't think they were in Egypt for more than a year before Herod dies here. And so when he dies, the angel says, okay, now you can come back out of Egypt. You can come back into Israel. It's safe now. For those who were trying to take the child's life are dead. So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus, son of Herod, was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. Now, Archelaus was like his father, but Archelaus only lasted for like 10 years. He was so bad, both of his brothers and Judeans and Samaritans, they all went to the emperor and said, you have got to get rid of this guy. And so he was expelled after just 10 years. I mean, within the first month that he was crowned, he was like a governor over this area. He killed off like 3,000 people. Like he was just savage, right? And so when Joseph hears that Archelaus is there, he's like, we can't bring our family back there. It's as bad or worse than Herod was. And so he goes to Galilee. Now, Galilee was ruled by his son. That was Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas is the one, later on when Jesus is crucified and things are going back and forth between Pilate and Herod. It's Herod Antipas. It's the brother of Archelaus. He lasts a long time. Obviously, he wasn't great. He killed off John the Baptist. He worked towards having Jesus killed. I mean, he's not fantastic, but he wasn't his brother. He was better than Archelaus. And so they end up heading off to Galilee, a podunk, backwoods area far away from Jerusalem. And Jesus never even comes back to Jerusalem until Herod Antipas is gone. That's like when he comes back to the temple when he was a young boy. So Joseph brings his family this king that he's raising, and he brings his family back, and he raises them up in a place where they would have no status, no privilege, nothing interesting about them, partly for their own safety, I'm sure, but I wonder from Joseph's perspective if he's wondering, like, was this the right call? I mean, like, I'm raising the king. Shouldn't the king be in Jerusalem? No, I'm bringing the king back to no place, nowhere, and I'm raising him in safety. And I don't know if he doubted himself, if he questioned, like, am I doing the right thing here? It says that, well, it was quoted by, it was a prophet said that he would be called a Nazarene, but it's not in the Old Testament. Nowhere in the Old Testament does it say, and the king will be a Nazarene. It does say there's the word for branch or root sounds like that. It's Nazar, and so maybe Matthew was referring to Isaiah when it says that a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. Maybe he's referring to that. I don't know, but it's not like Joseph had a clear prophetic message that that Jesus would have to come from Galilee. My point is, like, as I'm reading this story, I hear so much about Joseph and Mary being told exactly what to do, being given these gifts, told when to go to Egypt, when to come back, and everything. And still, if I put myself in the story, I would have to think, am I doing what's right here? I've been given this massive responsibility. Am I being faithful enough with what I've been given? And I have to tell you, like, as I put myself in, you know, Joseph's spot, like, I think about, you know, I'm not called to raise the Messiah or anything, but I got two daughters, you know, and haven't been faithful with that, you know. I have friends and family. I have responsibilities. Have I been faithful? And so much of this story depends on Joseph being that righteous man that we hear about right from the start. Most of his life, he's not told exactly what to do. Mary and him aren't told exactly what they have to do. You see later on, they're confused about what he's doing at the temple. Mary's upset sometimes with what Jesus has to say out in public. Don't listen to him. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm sure that they made a lot of mistakes. But these were people who, to the best of their ability, were righteous. That means that they came to understand the will of God. And to the best of their ability, they lived out the will of God. And that was enough. That was enough to place the Messiah in their hands. The salvation of the entire world was left to be raised in a nowhere town, no place, nothing, from a couple of nobodies, except to the best of their ability, they were righteous. And that was enough to prepare the way for the salvation of the entire world. There's phrases like, oh, God works in mysterious ways. Man, God works through very small, simple people. And it's easy to look at Mary and Joseph and think like, man, they're big deals. I guarantee you they didn't feel like they were big deals. They had to have felt like they were in over their heads. And if so, man, that's no different than us. God has given us daily responsibilities to the best of our ability to be faithful to our responsibilities, to be faithful to what he's called us to, and not because he's given us exact details about how to do it, but he's told us how we can be righteous, how we can know his heart and his will, and to the best of our ability to make our choices based on character that's been formed by his will. That's what the story rests on. Two people, nobodies from nowhere, to the best of their ability, doing what they saw was God's will based on the formation of their character. For all of the craziness, the kings and the gold and the myrrh and the visits from the angel and all that kind of stuff, that's what I take from this story. Mary and Joseph were righteous. Let's pray. Father God, I thank you for the example that Joseph set throughout this story in loving his wife and in loving his child and being faithful to you and to the best of his ability being righteous and being humble enough that when he discovered that what he was planning was wrong, that he changed it without any thought. Lord, I pray that I can be that kind of man, and I pray that I can be surrounded by that kind of people. Lord, that whatever it is that you want us to do isn't wrapped up in us being important people, or God, maybe we're just nobodies from nowhere, but to the best of our ability, we're righteous. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.